Anatomy and Physiology, the Senses, Part 3. In this section, we're going to talk about the ear. And remember, there are two special senses in the ear. They include hearing and equilibrium. If you don't know what equilibrium means, just pencil in right next to it the word balance, because equilibrium means balance. Let's take a look at some general basic anatomy of the ear first. On this slide, we see that someone has conveniently divided the ear into three general regions. The part on the outside, we're going to call the outer or the external ear. This smaller area in the middle will be termed the middle ear. And then the part of the ear that's on the inside, someone called that the inner ear. And that's where all the hearing goodies are. Notice also your book has these regions color-coded. So take a look at that figure from your text if you need sort of a general overview. We'll begin with the outer ear, and there's only three major parts I want you to know. First, this flap of skin and cartilage on the outside of our head, that has a name. It's called the auricle. Auricle, the root word, means ear, so that's a good name for that. There's a synonym for the auricle I want you to know. Some people call it the pinna. I'm not big on synonyms, as you know. There's like five names for everything in anatomy, but I'll only whip out synonyms when they're used commonly in the real world. The auricle has a couple parts. The windy part is called the helix that I'm tracing over now. And you're familiar with the root word helix because you studied the double helix of DNA, and you know that just means a windy, twisty thing. And then we have the little part down here where we get our ears pierced maybe, and that piece is called the lobule. The auricle actually has a purpose. That flap does direct sound waves into the external auditory canal and towards the eardrum that we will now call the tympanic membrane. Your root words will help you here. Tympani means a drum. So the tympanic membrane, translated in Greek, means the drum membrane. So that's kind of a cool root word to know. If you don't think this thing really works, here's what you could do next time maybe you're talking with someone in a room or next time you're in a lecture class. And I'm not telling you to do this. I'm just saying if you were to kind of cup your ears forward or cup your auricles forward with your hands, as someone was talking, they almost sound twice as loud. So the auricles really do help us hear. And if someone loses their auricle due to cancer or trauma, they won't hear, you know, quite as well as a normal person would. That reminds me of a couple of special situations of trauma. One is in high school. You may have seen high school wrestlers. They get their ears ground into the mat. They develop a deformity called cauliflower ear. It's very difficult to fix the ear, especially the part of the ear where the cartilage is. I don't know anybody with cauliflower ear who's ever gotten it fixed. I used to be a high school wrestler, wasn't very good, got a dislocated shoulder and a broken nose, but I did see a lot of people with cauliflower ear. And again, very difficult to fix. Reminds me also of the Evander Holyfield-Mike Tyson fight where Mike Tyson bit off Holyfield's ear. I don't know if anybody remembers that from way back when. But I can only assume that that fellow was a multimillionaire, but even with all his millions, I'm not sure he ever got that fixed. That's how hard it is to get fixed. So we want to avoid damage to that. That's why if you see a little, maybe a little skin cancer starting on there, you want to get it early before it eats the auricle off the head. That's why I told my teenager, I told her, don't get your ear pierced up here where the cartilage is. Get it pierced down here on the lobule because I've seen infections of that cartilage and it could eat it off the head pretty much. So the auricle really is fairly important. They are trying new surgical techniques now where they're shaving rib cartilage off to try to repair the auricle. Interesting stuff. The next part of the outer ear is this little tunnel right here. It's called the external auditory canal, which just means outer ear tunnel. It is lined with a few hairs and some modified sweat glands called ceruminous glands, which form cerumen. Let's break that down a little bit. Why are there hairs in this external auditory canal? they're there for protection. They can trap things. As a matter of fact, I saw during residency, I saw some little kitties with insects, including roaches in their ears that we had to pull out. Same thing with the cerumen. First of all, in regular old English, what is cerumen? Cerumen is earwax, but we're going to call it cerumen now. Notice also, since these are modified sweat glands, earwax is actually modified sweat. So that's something to think about too. Now, why is the cerumen there? Same purpose. It's one of our non-specific immune defenses. It protects us. It can, again, trap things, for example. And then one semester when I was giving this talk in a face-to-face class, this girl raised her hand after I said this, and she said, "Well, Dr. Gonshore, what about candling?" And I said, "I don't know. What about candling?" And she told me what it was, and apparently you light some kind of a cone-shaped paper on fire, and then you put it near your ear, and then the heat is supposed to melt the wax, and I guess the wax comes out of your ear and into the cone, and then I don't know what you do with it. I mean, is it like playing with Play-Doh? I don't get the whole thing. First of all, we're not supposed to remove our earwax unless it's causing a problem. You know, there are cases where it affects the hearing or causes ringing in the ears, and the ear specialist will take it out. But in general, we're supposed to leave it alone. And then when I Googled this whole candling thing, I actually found an article from like the Ear, Nose, and Throat Doctors Association, and it said people should not do candling. And it kind of made sense to me. And one of the risks they mentioned in the article was you might catch on fire. So, yeah, I don't think we should be candling either. Okay, last part of the outer ear is the tympanic membrane, sort of a semi-translucent membrane. This is the dividing line between the external auditory canal and the next part of the ear that we'll talk about called the middle ear. So the eardrum is sort of a dividing line between the outer and the middle ear. And yes, we will see shortly it's going to vibrate due to the mechanical pressure of sound waves. We'll talk about the middle ear on this slide, a few basic concepts. Number one, notice where this chamber is. It's inside the temporal bone. That's actually very important to know. That will come into play when you start dealing with your trauma victims who have skull fractures. You should know that normally the middle ear chamber is filled with air. If there's not supposed to be pus, there's not supposed to be blood or anything else, no fluid, just air. And the doctors, when they stick that thing in your ear, that black thing that hurts, they can see through that eardrum and they can look into the middle ear. And if there is fluid in there or pus, or it's inflamed, they might diagnose your patient with an infection. If there's blood back there, that could be due to trauma as well. So you need to know what normally is in there. The second important fact about the middle ear is it contains the opening of something called the eustachian or the auditory tube. That's a very important tube. Most people call it the eustachian tube. I have a slide dedicated just to that. And the third bullet point on this slide is the middle ear is the location of these three tiny ear bones that we will not call the ear bones. We will call them the auditory ossicles. I would like to spend some time talking about the eustachian tube. Notice this tube connects the middle ear to the back of the throat that's behind your nose, and that structure is called the nasopharynx. The purpose of this is to equalize the pressure on both sides of the eardrum. Through the external auditory canal, we have this opening to the outside world, and then the middle ear has another opening called the eustachian tube, which leads to the back of the throat. And when the eustachian tube is open, that will equalize the pressure on both sides of your eardrum. The eustachian tube often is closed, and we have to do things sometimes to open it. I'll give you some examples. If you ever maybe went diving, you know that you have to do something if you're a diver to equalize the pressure on both sides of the eardrum, or else it'll stretch. And when that eardrum stretches, it's got a lot of nerves in it and it hurts. Another example that maybe we all are more familiar with is going up and down on the plane. There are pressure changes that take place when you go up and down on the plane, and we have to equalize the pressure on both sides of the eardrum, or else it'll stretch out or stretch in and it hurts. So what do we do to open up the flexible eustachian tube on the plane ride? Some people might chew gum, maybe you swallow, maybe you eat some food, yawning. People do other things to open that tube and equalize that pressure. The thing that's clinically really important here is that eustachian tube can possibly be a source of disease, especially in little kitties. And I want you to know about something called otitis media. Media means middle. Oto, like otoscope or otolaryngologist, means ear, and itis means infection. So if you bring your child to the doctor and he's diagnosed with otitis media, that means a middle ear infection. The doctor probably saw redness or fluid or pus in the middle ear. How's that happen? Well, here's the deal. The child maybe gets an infection, some kind of microorganism in the back of their throat. Then those little buggers, they climb up the throat through the eustachian tube and they get inside the middle ear. As the bugs are tracking up the eustachian tube, they inflame the tube and it swells shut. Now the bacteria are trapped in this nice warm chamber inside your head. It's like a little incubator, and the bacteria can grow wild in there. So that's kind of how the little kitties get an infection. And then with knowledge of this anatomy, what do the doctors do to treat it? Sure, you know, they put them on antibiotics, but if kids keep getting them over and over again, one of the things they do is put tubes in the ears. So they make a little slit in the eardrum, they put a tube in there that relieves the pressure, that relieves the pain, that can let the pus and fluid drain out of there, that lets air in there, and air also helps to heal infections. So just by knowing the anatomy here and the physiology, that's how doctors came up with that idea. This slide reminds me of a true story. Speaking of going up on the airplanes, you know, there's always that screaming baby, and the screaming baby always seems to be next to me on the plane. And when we had our last child, he was 1 year old. We were taking him on a plane ride, so we asked the pediatrician, what do we do so we don't have the screaming baby on the plane? Because you can't tell the baby to chew gum or swallow or yawn. And he said, it's easy. You just give them a bottle. So feed them a bottle when you're going up and when you're going down on the plane, and then the baby won't cry from ear pain. So we go on our first airplane ride with him. We're stuck on the tarmac for 3 hours. He's crying now because he's starving, he's hungry. We feed him the bottle, he sucks it down. Then the plane finally takes off. And of course, he starts screaming. And so we were the parents with the screaming baby. Also in the middle ear, we have the auditory ossicles. In Greek, that means ear bones. In grade school, they used to teach us the name of these bones. They nicknamed them the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup. Those aren't the real names. When I mention that now, most students say they're not even taught that in grade school anymore, but we were told it's the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup because their shapes sort of represent those different things. What are the real names, though? In order, they are the malleus, which is the bone that attaches to the tympanic membrane. Then next in the chain is the incus. Then finally in the chain is the stapes. And don't miss it on the test if anybody ever asks you, because automatically it forms a nice mnemonic. M-I-S for Malleus Incus Stapes. That spells miss. Don't miss it on the test. And the stapes, which really is shaped like a stirrup, isn't it, attaches to a thin membranous structure called the oval window with a star. This is critical, you'll see, when we do the physiology of hearing, because the oval window, maybe you want to write it down here, is the window into the inner ear. What else is cool about this is because of the setup and the physics of the whole deal, the arrangement of the bones and the size and shape of the membranes, we have a built-in amplifier inside of our head. And when sound goes from the tympanic membrane to the oval window, there's a 20 times amplification in the sound. So kind of cool, we got a built-in amp inside of our head. Something else interesting here that's mostly trivial pursuit. These three ear bones are the smallest bones in the human body. And when you study joints, maybe you remember studying a synovial joint, like a big, complicated knee joint you studied when you did that earlier in anatomy. Well, believe it or not, the joints between these bones are actually true full-blown synovial joints. Just really hard to imagine when you think about that. But it's just trivial pursuit for this point in time. Finally, we get to the all-important inner ear. This is where all the action is. Let's get oriented first. Here is in blue, showing the inner ear getting sucked out of, again, the temporal bone. They sucked it out, blew it up real big in this drawing, and there it is. What a funky-shaped, weird-looking gizmo that thing is. Generally, this is a series of fluid, underline fluid, filled canals deep inside, once again, the temporal bone. Underline that too. It has what we call an outer bony labyrinth. In other words, there's an outer bony shell shown here in yellow and tan. And there's an inner matching membranous labyrinth shown here in orange and in pink. Let's break this down a little bit. What does labyrinth mean? I mean, the first person who found this hundreds of years ago looked at it and said, man, that's a weird shape. I think I'll call it a labyrinth. Well, labyrinth means a maze, and it does have a complicated shape, like a maze does. You may even see patients go to the doctor, and maybe they're having some kind of problem with their ear, maybe a balance problem or what have you, and the doctor diagnoses them with labyrinthitis. Well, if you didn't know what the labyrinth was, you wouldn't know where the itis was either. So that's why it's important to know the name labyrinthitis. Often when I get to this slide, students ask me, what about vertigo and that sort of thing? And it's really interesting, the theories about vertigo. These are fluid-filled canals with water and ions inside there. And some people think that vertigo or dizziness and balance problems might be caused by the improper proportions or amounts of ions in the fluid. In particular, they've implicated, I think, potassium is one of those ions that might be out of whack and can cause vertigo. Another theory is that maybe the pressure is too high in these fluid-filled canals, and that might lead to dizziness. In the old days, we even treated people with water pills to try to alleviate their symptoms. They have newer drugs now, of course. Even though this picture looks complicated, I want to simplify it for you. I want you to think of this like an oyster. Maybe get a picture of an oyster to look at off the internet or just draw one. An oyster has an outer bony hard shell, then an inner matching meaty membranous functioning part, the actual oyster. And the oyster is surrounded by water. And if you took the oyster and squished it water would come out of that too. And that's kind of the setup here. We have a hard outer bony shell. It's just a really funky shape compared to an oyster shell. We have an inner matching membranous mushy squishy part. That would be the oyster or the snail inside the shell. That's the functioning part. That's where the action is. And there's water inside that as well. So think of it like an oyster, and I think that will really help you get you organized in sort of a 3D fashion. It's hard to understand the inner ear unless you got a 3D thing going on. And the problem is, unlike the eye that we can just kind of see in the mirror, you probably haven't seen your inner ear, because unless you cracked your skull and this thing fell out of your head, which I hope is nobody listening to this, you've never seen your inner ear before. I've got a good summary slide here. Just calm down on this slide. It's a slide to come back to at the end of the unit to try to put it all together. But it really is a good summary that I put together here. So here's the deal. Here's the inner ear. It's got an outer bony labyrinth, an outer shell, and an inner matching membranous labyrinth. That's the inner matching functioning part. That would be the snail inside the snail shell. And like always in anatomy, somebody had to name every part of the shell, and someone also gave a different name to each oyster or snail inside the shell. So, in summary, this part of the shell that's shown in yellow is called the cochlea. Cochlea means spiral shell, and it really is shaped like one of those spiral shells you find at the beach, and that's exactly how it got its name. The next part of the bony labyrinth is this tan sort of ovalish chamber right here. That's called the vestibule. All the vestibule means is a chamber. There's lots of vestibules in anatomy, and all it is a chamber. The last part of the bony seashell is over here. It looks like a series of three loop-de-loops, like on a roller coaster. There are three canals shaped like half circles. So someone named this part of the shell the semicircular canals. And there's a built-in mnemonic here as well. CVS, like the pharmacy. I'm not plugging that pharmacy, of course. But CVS does give you a good mnemonic for the three names of the three sections of the outer bony shell. Now let's name the oysters inside the shells. Inside the cochlea, shown here in orange, that snail is called the cochlear duct. And that's cool because it's that, you know, cochlea is the name of the shell and the cochlear duct is the name of the snail in the shell. What about this shell called the vestibule? What's the name of the oysters that are sitting inside there? Well, there's two pink sac-like structures called the utricle and the saccule that we'll talk about. Those are the inner matching functioning parts inside the vestibule. Finally, what we'll study at the end of this unit, in pink again, we have these half-circle shaped ducts. Soft, this is a soft, chewy part inside that where all the action takes place, and someone called them the semicircular ducts. I didn't do this on purpose, and I don't condone it, of course, in any way, but just the way this slide turned out when I made it, it's spelled in mnemonic as well. I'm going to circle these letters. It's C-U-S-S. Now, of course, we don't do that in class, but there's a mnemonic for knowing the membranous parts of the inner ear in order. What about function? The function of the cochlea, which is shaped like a seashell, we'll see is hearing, and that's easier for me to remember because when my mama and daddy took me to the beach, they said, pick up that seashell, hold it up to your ear, and you'll hear something. And so I always remember the seashell part is the hearing part. And then up and to the left of this figure where it's just pink and tan, kind of looks like a roller coaster to me. And I remember on the roller coaster, I maybe get out of balance. So I never forget that this pink and tan stuff, That's where all our balance stuff is that we'll talk about in some detail. Let's begin with the cochlea. Again, that's this part of the bony labyrinth. It is shaped like a spiral shell. That's what the root word means. So the cochlea is the seashell. And it has these winds or turns. There are turns of the seashell. Just think of one on the beach. Hopefully you're seeing this in lab about the same time. But let's go ahead and take a look inside here. Pretend I have a bone saw, a very small bone saw, and I make a cut through one turn of the bony seashell. What is inside each turn of the bony seashell? We will see there are three fluid-filled canals, three membranes, and some special hearing cells. That's the basic setup. If you're not understanding the 3D situation on this slide, we can cut it another way. Let me now take a bone saw and cut this way. I'll cross-section from the tip of the bony seashell, which is poking out of the slide, and then cut into the base of the bony seashell. So let's cut it in half, take the top half off, and look inside. So here's just another view of the cochlea and what's inside the bony turns of the seashell as they wind to the tip. We will see there are three fluid-filled canals, three membranes, and a special hearing organ. On this slide, what we did was take a high mag view of one cut, one turn of the bony seashell. So this is a high mag section through one turn of the cochlea. And here we have one, two, three fluid-filled canals. We have one, two, three membranes, and then a special hearing organ that we'll talk about. Let's go ahead and name these like you probably already did in lab. First, the top fluid-filled chamber is called the scala vestibuli. And again, vestibule just means a chamber. So someone called this fluid-filled bony chamber the chamber, the scala vestibuli. And the membrane that's associated with the scala vestibuli that always separates it from the middle duct of the cochlea is the vestibular membrane. And it's not too hard for my pea brain to remember. The vestibular membrane always goes with the scala vestibuli and separates it from the middle canal. The middle canal, I'll circle it here with my arrow. That's the membranous part. That's the snail. That's the mushy, gushy part. That has all the functioning junk in it. So the middle canal in the cochlea has a name. It is called the cochlear duct. And that works for my pea brain too. I mean, the whole thing is called the cochlea, and the main duct in the middle of the cochlea is the cochlear duct. So that's easier for me to remember as well. Finally, there's a chamber down below, a fluid-filled canal. This bony canal is called the scala tympani. Remember, by the way, tympani, the root word means drum, and that's going to help us in just a couple of minutes. The membrane shown here that always goes with the scala tympani and separates it from the cochlear duct is the basilar membrane. How do I remember the basilar membrane always goes with the scala tympani and separates it from that middle canal called the cochlear duct? Well, here's my story. In high school, I was in the band, and I was a drummer in the band. And I got kicked out of high school band. That's a whole other story, because as some of you know, it's pretty hard to get kicked out of high school band. Let's leave that alone and move on. Here's how I use it to help me memorize a bit about ear anatomy and physiology. I remember that tympani is a kind of a drum. There is a drum called a tympani drum. There's also a kind of a drum called a bass drum. So I remember that the drums always go together. So the scala tympani always goes with the basilar membrane. And furthermore, to help me with physiology coming up on the next slides, What I do is I make myself real small. I picture myself standing here in the scale of tympani. And I hold my big bass drumsticks in my hand. And I bang on the basilar membrane just like I'm playing the bass drum. And you'll see shortly how that will help, hopefully help you remember the physiology of hearing. On the next slide, what we're going to do is we're going to take out this rectangular box. That's where the hearing organ is and all the special cells. We're going to blow it up, slap it on a slide, and break it down. So this is the hearing organ. It is called the organ of Corti, also called the spiral organ. Again, not a big fan of synonyms, but they're used interchangeably. It is the organ of hearing, and it always rests on the all-important basilar membrane. That's right, at the base of the hearing organ is the basilar membrane. If it wasn't there, I just think it would fall out. So it's got to rest on something. The organ of Corti contains special receptors for hearing. They're right here drawn as yellow cells, and they are called hair cells. The hearing cells are hair cells. They're called hair cells because at the tip of each hair cell is something called a hair bundle. Now, they're not really hairs. It's not like the hair's growing out of an old man's ear that needs a little trimming job. They're more like a kind of a cilia we call a stereo cilia. But those structures, those hair bundles, are critical for the physiology of hearing. Also, a general principle in anatomy, especially here in the ear, wherever we have hairs, we have a hair gel. I ask my students in my face-to-face class, how do you think I keep my hair looking so nice? Always got to have a hair gel on top of the hair. So wherever there's a hair cell, there's a hair gel. And there's a different name for the gel depending on where we are in the body. Here is the clear gelatinous membrane that covers the top of the hair cells. It's called the tectorial membrane. And I love the root word tect. Tect means on the top. Like the tectum was the top or the roof of the midbrain. The tectorial membrane is right on top of the hair cells. And the little hair bundles are really embedded inside the hair gel. Not really hair gel, the tectorial membrane. Now that we know all the pieces and parts, it's time to put it all together and discuss the physiology of hearing. This is one of those things where on the test, I like to see if you could put everything in the right order, because that really tells me that you know your stuff. We're going to work through this together, fill in the blanks together if you haven't already done that. And after you go through it a few times and rehearse it at home, you will get this down. It's really not that bad at all. It kind of goes like this. So I'm sitting at the stoplight, and the car next to me has got these big bass speakers going and shaking my whole car. And I'm thinking to myself, are they really enjoying that music, or are they doing that to annoy the old guy in the car next to them? I kind of think it's the latter of those two choices. I also researched on the internet how much those speakers cost. And it seems to me like they're worth more than some of the cars I see out there in the parking lot. In any case, picture those big bass speakers going. And that will remind you, by the way, that hearing really is a mechanical sense, because those pressure waves are directed by the auricle. That's right, the auricle directs those big bass speaker sound waves into the external auditory canal. It directs those sound waves against the eardrum, which we will now call the tympanic membrane, causing the tympanic membrane to vibrate back and forth. Those vibrations, in turn, will then cause the ear bones to rattle. We're not going to call them ear bones. We're going to call them the auditory ossicles. And in order, we're first going to shake the malleus, then the incus, and then finally, the stapes. And remember, the stapes presses against and vibrates the all-important oval window with the star, because the oval window is the window into the inner ear. And this is one of the key steps. When you shake the oval window, you vibrate the water in all the fluid-filled canals we just learned inside the inner ear. Picture having a glass of water in your hand, then maybe take a stick and smack that glass of water. Won't you notice a bunch of ripples on the surface? Yeah, that's the mechanical vibrations we're talking about. And then, once you vibrate all the water in all those fluid-filled canals, the next most important thing to happen is that those fluid pressure waves vibrate the all-important basilar membrane. That's right, we shake the basilar membrane. And if I shake the basilar membrane, I'm going to shake these special hearing cells on the top, aren't I? Called the hair cells. And then if I start the hair cells a shaking, that's going to cause the hair bundles that are embedded in the tectorial membrane to bend. Because remember, those hair bundles aren't just floating in the breeze. They're buried in the hair gel. So be the bass drummer, bang on the basilar membrane, shake the hair cells, which will then cause the hair bundles to bend within the tectorial membrane. And that's where the magic happens. The mechanical bending of the hair bundle is converted into electrical signals, because that's the only thing the brain can understand. And those electrical signals from the hair cells, they connect or synapse with the cochlear branch, that's the hearing branch, of the vestibulocochlear nerve. That's the balance and hearing nerve. The rest of the pathway goes like this. The nerve impulses from the hearing branch of the balance and hearing nerve travel from the inner ear to the brainstem, as you know, and then relay through the relay station that you know is called the thalamus. Remember those eggs in your head? And the eggs relay those signals to the noodles, right? To the cerebrum, to the part of the brain that can interpret what you just heard with a star on it. And you should know what lobe of the cerebrum we're talking about. Make the connections between this and what you studied in the brain. Please, if you don't remember, pencil in now. It's the temporal lobes. And that's easier for me to remember because my ears are sitting right over the temporal lobes. While you're making notes, while you're maybe writing down some of the tips and tricks I gave you, let me tell you about a couple of fascinating things that you don't have to know for this course. But you might have heard of something called a cochlear implant. Cochlear implants are done in people who have deafness. In particular, they're done for people who have deafness due to damage to the hair cells. You know, mommy told me, don't listen to loud music. It's because you're going to damage your hearing. And she was right. I listened to too much loud music, too many concerts, damage the hair cells. But is there hope for me? And the answer is yes, as long as my cochlear branch, my hearing branch, is intact. Because what they do basically with a cochlear implant, they have a sort of a microphone deal that you see hooked onto the outside of somebody's ear. There's wires hooked up to that, to a transducer. Then they have to drill a hole through the temporal bone, and they thread the electrodes from this device right into the cochlear branch of the balance and hearing nerve. So as long as the person doesn't have nerve deafness, you can bypass damaged hair cells by jacking electrodes right into the hearing nerve. And so those people can then hear again. Now, it's not the same as you and I might hear, but it sure is a big improvement. Then there's something very interesting called otoacoustic emissions. What does that word mean? The words mean ear sound emissions. In English, there are sounds emitted by the ear. If the inner ear, if this hearing organ is working properly, it's vibrating, right? And things that vibrate make a sound. Now, if this is working right, it's vibrating and it is making a sound. We can't normally hear that, but someone who was super smart thought of this idea to maybe test a baby to see if they're deaf. They designed a super duper sensitive microphone and they hooked it up to a super duper computer and they put the microphone next to the baby's ear. And if they detect these certain sounds, these certain vibrations called otoacoustic emissions, it's a rough way of telling if the baby can actually possibly hear. There's other ways to do it. There's also electrical tests to do it, similar to the one I described when we did the eye. But just fascinating that someone even thought about creating such a test. And in the last part of this unit, we'll talk about what's called the vestibular apparatus. In English, these are the receptor organs for balance. That's this stuff up here in pink in the diagram from your book. There are two general organs for balance in the inner ear. Number one, we have what's called the utricle and the saccule. Number two, we have the semicircular ducts. We'll look at those two organs one at a time in that order. Starting with this slide, the utricle and the saccule, I have little red stars on them. They're little fluid-filled membranous sacs. As a matter of fact, the names utricle and saccule mean little bag and little sac. And they are little bags and little sacs that are located inside of this part of the tan bony shell that you might remember is called the vestibule. So on the test, if I ask you where the utricle and saccule are, notice utricle and saccule, that spells U-S. So where are us located? If I ask you where us are located, we are located in the chamber called the vestibule. And if you were like me, if you were the first one to ever find this at an autopsy and you found this little bag and this little sac inside this chamber, wouldn't you want to cut it open to see what was inside? And that's exactly what someone did. So on the next slide, we're going to slice inside the little bag and the little sac and take a peek in there, and what you'll find is a thickened region called a macula. I know you're thinking, hey, didn't we have a macula in the eye? We did. Now we have one in the ear. Don't let it freak you out. It just means a flat area. So this is a thickened flat region you can find in the utricle and the saccule. Two general types of cells here. Notice some cells in blue with hair bundles on the top. And what did some genius call the special sensory cells with hair bundles on the top? They call them hair cells. And then we also have the cells in sort of a tannish color, and those are supporting cells. And those supporting cells do something very special. They secrete the gel. Remember I told you, wherever there's a hair cell, there's going to be a hair gel. And the supporting cells secrete this gelatinous membrane. And this gelatinous membrane also contains a bunch of crystals in it. And the name given to this membrane with crystals in it is called the otolithic membrane. The crystals that sit on top of the jelly, they are called otoliths. Now that we know the main players involved here, let's break it down and see how it all works. This slide is titled The Physiology of Static Equilibrium. That means, how does this part of the ear help us in balance? It helps us with our static balance. That means our non-moving or stationary balance. And it goes like this, and I often just use myself as an example in front of the class so you can maybe picture that. If I tilt my head to the right, what's going to happen to the otoliths, the ear stones by gravity? They're going to fall down to the right. And those rocks are embedded in the gel called the otolithic membrane. So if the rocks fall down to the right, they're going to tug on the jelly-like membrane, and that's going to get pulled down to the right as well. And recall that the hair cells have hair bundles embedded in the hair gel. So if we bend the hair gel down to the right, we're going to bend the hair bundles on the hair cells as well. And that, again, is where all the magic happens. The mechanical bending is converted into electrical signals, which leads to a nerve impulse that travels along the balance branch of the balance and hearing nerve, which technically is the vestibular branch of the vestibulocochlear nerve. Then you know from there that impulses travel to the brainstem and eventually also communicate with that tiny little bowl of angel hair pasta that hangs off the back portion of your brain, the part of your brain that's responsible for balance, coordination, and posture. It is the all-powerful cerebellum with a star. So what? So that, even with my eyes closed, if I tilt my head to the right, I know it's tilted to the right. And if I choose to, I could straighten myself back up to maintain my posture and my balance. That's the importance of this mechanism. The last part of the vestibular apparatus we'll talk about are the semicircular ducts. These are the other balance organs. These are shown off here to your left in pink as these fluid-filled membranous channels that are within and match the outer tan bony semicircular canals. Notice they're roughly arranged at right angles to each other. And it's this arrangement, it's this beautiful design that allows us to determine sort of which way we're being twisted in space. It really is a wonderful design. Notice at the base of each loop-de-loop, at the base of each semicircular duct, there is a dilated bulbous structure. It looks like an onion bulb to me, but it has a name. It is called the ampulla. All an ampulla is in anatomy is a dilated area. There are many things in anatomy called an ampulla. And if you were like me and you were the first one to ever find this, what would you want to do? You'd want to crack it open. I'd want to get a pair of nutcrackers out. I'd crack that shell open, then cut through that pink onion bulb. And what would you find inside? You would find this crest-like structure that someone called the cristae. Cristae, the root word, just means a crest. And it does look like the crest of a cardinal or a crest of a blue jay. So that's what's inside the ampulla. Shown here, blown up really big. So we took the ampulla, we cut it open, we blew it up really big and looked inside. We found this crest called a cristae. And what's in the cristae? Once again, here's a recurrent theme. We got these blue cells, these sensory receptors, called hair cells. And on top of the hair cells are hair bundles with a star. And wherever there are hair bundles in the ear, remember there's a hair gel. And there's a different name for the hair gel depending on where we are. The mass of jelly that sits on top of these hair cells is called the cupula. The cupula is the jelly that covers the cristae. And here's how I remember it. I just picture my head as the crest of a bird. And then I've got hairs, you know, growing out the top of my head. And then I dump a cup of jelly. You get it? Cup of jelly, cupula. Well, anyway, that's how I remember it. You could come up with your own way. The next slide says, how does it all work? The physiology of dynamic equilibrium. In other words, moving balance. And it's sort of the same story. When the head moves, like you're getting twisted on the roller coaster, on a corkscrew or a loop-de-loop, of course, the semicircular ducts are moving too, and the hair cells are moving too. and the fluid with inside those ducts is moving as you're getting swirled around on the roller coaster, and the fluid within the ampulla bends the hair gel, it bends the cupula. If I slosh the fluid past the cupula and bend that, I then will also bend the hair bundles. If I bend the hair bundles, that mechanical bending gets converted into electrical signals. That again is where the magic happens. And those nerve impulses travel along, once again, the balance branch of the balance and hearing nerve, which you know has connections to the brainstem, but also importantly communicates with that all-powerful balance part of our brain called the cerebellum, with the star again. So that what? So that as I'm sitting in my chair on a roller coaster going through corkscrews and loop-de-loops, if I choose to, I can hold myself up in position in that chair. That's the purpose of this. Before I leave this slide, I think you could tell how much I think of the cerebellum. We talked about it a lot during the brain chapter and again now in the senses chapter. I'd like to have a little fun with the cerebellum for a moment. You don't have to do this. Don't do anything I tell you to do. The cerebellum is magical, but it's not perfect. If you were to try to take your right foot and make clockwise circles with your right foot, and then take your right hand at the same time and try to draw the number 6 in the air with your right hand, most of you will notice that things will kind of go kaflooey. So the cerebellum is really cool, but it's not perfect if you try that exercise. Also, the cerebellum, very, very sensitive device, and the police use that to their advantage. They know that ethanol, for example, can throw off the balance part of your brain. Ethanol, that is alcohol, can throw off this mechanism. So when the police officer pulls someone over for suspicion of being under the influence, all those silly tests they do, that's all to test the cerebellum out. And if it's out of whack, that's a good sign that maybe the cerebellum has been affected by alcohol intoxication. So that's how we'll end this unit. Another fascinating, I think, collection of material that matches beautifully with the brain. It's great to connect the dots with those two chapters in particular.